Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Tonight, we are very, very excited to welcome to the store fantastic author, I believe. Hopefully you do too. He's got a master's in artificial intelligence and robotics, PhD in robotics from Carnegie Mellon, which is pretty awesome. So please join me here today to discuss the latest wonderful creepy book, Robogenesis. Please join me in welcoming Daniel Wilson.
Thank you for the introduction, and thanks to you guys for coming out tonight. So I'm just going to talk for about 10 minutes, and I'm going to read for 10 minutes and then take questions. As a writer, I am essentially home alone all day while my friends go to work, and I am often full of an extreme amount of enthusiasm about what I'm writing and whatever I've just come up with, and I have a strong desire to tell other human beings about it, whoever might be nearby, but unfortunately, I'm not really allowed to interact with humans very much during the day. So this sort of enthusiasm I have and lack of human contact is really bad news for my young daughter's nanny, who is trapped in the house with me during the day. So I wrote Robogenesis in the summer of 2012, and that was when my daughter was two. And the only person who was around all day was our nanny, who happens to be the sweetest, most gentle, nicest person who ever put a Band-Aid on a kid's knee. And every day, while my daughter was napping, I would find her and give her, really excited, I would give her a couple pages or a chapter of Robogenesis, whatever I had just completed. And then I'd just wait there expectantly, you know, while she read through it to find out what she thought. And after a couple of weeks of this, she came back to me and very quiet, and she brought the latest pages, and I took the opportunity to blurt out my favorite question, which is the question I always ask. It's the question my wife hates, because I've asked her this question 1,000 times about everything I've ever written and forced her to read, and because I think it sort of demonstrates a deep underlying narcissism that I have. And the question is, what was your favorite part? You know, of course, I'm an optimist, you know. So she kind of is quiet, and she looks up at me and says, I couldn't read it. And I grabbed the pages and saw that it was a part where a robot, you know, it's kind of a robot that's in the natural world. It's sort of like a slug. It sucks the legs, the skin off this kid's legs a little bit. It digests it. It was pretty intense, I guess, pretty gross. So, you know, I said to her, don't worry about it. You know, to show her that I was cool, and because it was dawning on me that forcing her to read this could be sort of construed as a type of workplace violence. And then I said, you know, I'm sorry about that. I should have warned you it was going to get that intense. And then I said, you know, what was your favorite part up until before the skin got sucked off the kid's legs, right? And that's because of the narcissism that I suffer from. So the novel is intense, you know, and I really meant for it to be. I went straight back to the scarred battlefields of Alaska to pick up right where I left off in Robopocalypse. And now that, so Robopocalypse had an interesting story. It sold to Random House or Doubleday and to DreamWorks on 100 pages, which, it was my first work of fiction. I was blown away. This was the best day of my life, right? It was a completely surreal experience. I was incredibly happy until it dawned on me that I now had to write my first novel, the rest of it, the next 200 pages, with a movie studio like demanding the pages from me, and also with a certain director attached to it. And so I realized, you know, oh yeah, no sweat, right? Just finish your half-completed first novel and make sure that it's going to satisfy a living legend. No pressure, right? Well, this time around, things were a little different, you know. So I was able to really take my time. I didn't have DreamWorks looking over my shoulder. And I wrote, first of all, a longer novel. I got a lot of complaints that Robopocalypse was not long enough, which I took as compliments. And And it's a lot more character-driven also. And it's, I also think it's a lot scarier and more personal than Robopocalypse. In fact, I just read a review that said the first chapter of Robogenesis is, quote, more frightening than the entirety of Robopocalypse. Some pretty gnarly stuff happens in Robopocalypse. I don't know. You'll have to judge for yourself. But Robogenesis is definitely a thriller. It's a novel that follows regular people and a few robots and a few in-betweens. You know, I like to blur the lines. It's not always clear who's a robot and who's not. And they're fighting and surviving in a world that's been transformed by the collapse of technology. And we're going beyond Robopocalypse. And so, you know, what I got really interested in for this novel, of course, I have this robotics background, so I'm constantly just indulging my inner nerd while I write this stuff. And so what I got really caught up in this time around was considering how human beings would realistically survive in a future that's populated by multiple titanic artificial intelligences that are at war with each other and not necessarily at war with people. And what's interesting to me about this is that unlike a natural species, AIs don't form any kind of natural class. So every one of these entities could be very different from the next one, depending on what architecture they're built on or what data sets they were trained on. They may not even know that human beings exist if they're designed to solve really deep, like, metaphysical problems or something. You know, the question is, would they want to manipulate human beings, ignore us? Would they try to eradicate us? And I feel like they would all have different answers to that question. So my job writing Robogenesis was pretty simple, right? I just had to describe godlike artificial intelligences with truly alien perspectives on humanity and devilishly complex motivations, kind of a Hannibal Lecter on steroids type of thing, brain steroids. Those don't exist. And I needed to make it really super realistic, because if I have any kind of strength as a writer, you know, or any kind of, you know, my MO is that I have this background as a roboticist, right? So I'm not the one who gets to screw around with the facts when it comes to the robots in my novels. And not that I ever would anyway. But so these AI characters that I'm describing, this whole direction I kind of went, it might sound a little bit cold and technical, but what I found really fascinating about the process was that the smarter the machines were, the better they were at manipulating human beings. And the way to manipulate human beings is with emotion. So I ended up with these really abstract, almost alien-like characters who were really intensely emotional as they were using levers like religion and love and hope to maneuver around all these human characters who were just trying to survive. So I'm going to wrap up my little talk by reading 10 minutes, a 10-minute passage to kind of illustrate this point about how human beings are manipulated. And let me give you a little background first. A lot of the characters in this novel are members of the Grey Horse Army from Robopocalypse, and they're marching back home to Oklahoma after they've finished this war that takes place in the first novel against an enemy that they call Arcos R-14. So a lot of these soldiers are Native American, which is kind of near and dear to me. So I'm a member of the Cherokee tribe. I grew up in northeastern Oklahoma. I mean, I vote. That's about it. I mean, it's not like I'm not deeply involved in tribal affairs. But it was only after I moved away from Oklahoma that I really realized this thing that was just sort of the background of where I grew up is not the same in other places. And you suddenly go, oh, wait, there aren't tons of Native Americans everywhere like where I grew up. So a lot of that, kind of my own background, goes into this. And these are people who survived the first novel. They survived the Robopocalypse because the sovereign government of the Osage Nation stayed intact when the rest of the federal government and world governments all fell apart with the collapse of technology. And so I actually visited Grey Horse this time around. It's a real place in Oklahoma. And in fact, all of anything that happens concerning the Osage in this novel and in the last novel is based on the actual tribe and real politics. And, you know, people really would go back to Grey Horse if there were an emergency. It's like a religious symbol. It's home, H-O-M-E, you know. So I went back there, and they were really welcoming. I met the chief, and I got to go on a big tour and everything. And the main thing I did while I was there was I apologized for destroying everything with robots in my novels again and again. So I was able to get that off my chest. So this excerpt that I'm going to read is from the perspective of a guy named Hank Cotton. And he's not a particularly sympathetic sort of guy. He's kind of racist, and he's kind of a jerk. And he's just kind of generally a good old boy, and not the good kind of good old boy. But he's also an Osage soldier who's just fought a war, and he's on his way home. So he's out in the woods in Alaska on the way home. Something metal clink, and I might get a little bit of Oklahoma accent in here on accident. I'll try to, you know, use my erudite accent that I have in real life, but it might seep in. Sorry. Something metal clinks in the trees behind me, and now my gut is speaking to me real clear. Hustle up, fat boy, is what it's saying. You got to daydreaming here in the woods and forgot there's murder among the trees. I spin around, rifle butt French kissing the meaty part of my shoulder. My eye is off the scope while I search for whatever made that noise. That's why I'm able to catch the flash of movement in my peripheral vision. It's a light quadruped, wolf-sized and damaged. I hear the clink again now that it's moving fast. It's had a bullet put through it at some point. Must have learned something from the experience because it keeps running off into the trees. I just about get a bead on it before it's gone. My cotton patrols don't use the radio for obvious reasons, and I can't risk calling out in case I attract more attention. It's important I stay hidden. Some of these leftover quads have serrated forelimbs like steak knives. They'll tear through your chest armor in the first lunge, and a second later they've got bladed rear feet up and scrabbling to disembowel you. One quad might be a nice dance, but two or more is a party you should regretfully decline. I stalk a few feet into the trees, placing each boot step careful and fast. My eyes open so wide they feel tight in the chilly air. The walker moves, leaving plain tracks, scraping like a drunk against an occasional tree trunk. It might be a wandering mapper variety, or it might have been part of a hunting pack, I don't know. But if it's really wounded, then I've got a singular chance to put it down before more can come join it. If it's got friends, then I'm most likely a dead man walking. For the next 10 minutes, it's just me and my breath and the frostbit rifle stock pressed against my numb cheek. God forgive me, but I didn't think this one all the way through. It seemed broken and slow, but the walker must have accelerated. The trail is gone, and this is an ambush, no doubt about it. I knew better than to hunt Rob. We all of us who fought the machines know better. You don't hunt Rob. He hunts you. I'm reaching for the radio to get some help and damn the consequences when I realize that maybe, just maybe, I'm not the dumbest son of a bitch on the planet. Maybe I'm the smartest, or at least the luckiest anyway. The thinking cube is wedged in half-melted snow at the base of a tree about 10 yards away, winking at me in cotton candy colors that stand out in the dark woods. It's the size of a child's block, and as I get closer, I can see that them keen colors are sort of floating away from the surface a few inches. The thing itself is pupil black, darker than coal. It's a brain box that must have dropped out of a big thinker, and it's still functioning. Even if it's broken out here in the snow, I can't believe my luck. We found a handful of these over the course of the whole war. A white boy soldier named Cormac Wallace even found one with a whole Rob War diary in it. I backsling my rifle and drop right to my knees in the slush, snatching up the cube in both hands. The hardware twinkles at me like a handful of rubies and diamonds, but this is worth more than gemstones, maybe a lot more. The woods are even darker now, and the pretty colors of this thing are flashing in my eyelashes like Christmas morning. The light it makes is hot against my cheeks. It's warming up my fingers through my gloves like a loaf of bread hot out of the oven. Up close, I can tell it's making real quiet noises, a flow of static like the breath of wind over a creek bed full of dry leaves. "Shh," says the cube. Well, I'm listening. I can't quite remember how it got this cold this fast. Feels like maybe the world is taking two breaths to my one, like things are jumping forward every time I blink my eyes. Now the strange light is getting downright hot on my skin, and my cheeks are feeling baked. All the snow's melted out of my whiskers, and water is seeping down over my little double chin and dripping off. Or hell, is that my own slobber? Either way, I don't wipe it off. The flashes and swirls of color are growing up big and shrinking down small now. For some reason, it strikes me as funny. I grin through my wet beard at the little dancing streaks. Spooklight. The word sneaks up through my brain like water through granite, and I mouth the words without making a sound. A chill courses down between my shoulder blades, and it hits me that I'm a man down on his knees and all alone in the black woods with a bauble in his fingers. It keeps on touching me with its light, putting whispers into the air, the whooshing voice of the deep black ocean and a seashell, and I swear it's saying something. I promise. I always thought the spooklight was just a story, but now I know it's real, and it's right here in my hands. My mama saw the spooklight out on the Oklahoma East 50 Highway. She was dating a boy from down there, the little border town of Hornet, Missouri. Legend in Hornet was that the spooklight showed up after the Trail of Tears come through. Thousands of men, women, and children near the end of a forced march, only the strong still alive, little babies dying on their mama's teat, most of the sacred elders gone off alone in the night to pass on. For 1,000 miles, day and night, it was the white man's rifle or another step forward, and both as deadly as the other. The legend was that this ball of light came folding out of the blood-soaked ground after it was over, kind of like a tombstone. Something from beyond this world, here to offer a reminder of how much men can suffer. Maybe this spooklight is the same. Is it here to mark our loss? God knows that men suffered in these woods. Mama didn't trust it. More than once, she told me to run if I ever saw the spooklight. That didn't scare me one bit, because hell, I thought her stories were just a bunch of old malarkey. She's full of those kind of tall tales, and she told that same one plenty of times over the years. Never gave me pause, but once. One time, Mama added something to the story. It was late, and I'd been acting up, and she must have been feeling worried about my mortal soul. The way she said what she did that night, so earnest, put goose pimples on my ribs. What she told me was that the time she saw the spook light, people started acting funny. Walking toward it, circling around, saying strange things to it, she said, and some people thought it was saying strange things back. That night, my mama took me by the arm, and she told me something extra. Don't pray to it, she said, and the back of my neck went cold. I already told you to run away if you see it, boy, but I know your mind, and you'll stay and watch. That's fine. It's in your nature to disobey, Hank. But in the name of the Lord, promise me that you won't ever get down on your knees and pray to it. With everything I got, I force my hands down. My joints are cracking, and I figure they haven't moved in hours. That raw light leaves my face, and I take a shuddering breath like a catfish in the well of a boat, because the air out here is suddenly so cold. Somehow, I will myself to drop the cube into the snow. There, Mama. I start to paw at my rifle. It's slung tight, and the strap is stiff and frozen, and I'm too fat to get it around the right way. These woods are going to swallow me up if I don't get out of here right now. Then I hear the noise. At first, I don't want to believe it, so I keep right on fidgeting, but the second time, I have to stop. It ain't like I want to, but I can't help myself, and I look down at that flickering cube of light in the snow. Hank, says the spook light, and that glow, it spreads out, you know. Like the words themselves, the light spreads out around the edges of things. No, I say, and it comes out a whimper. I've got the rifle off my shoulder now, and I'm tugging at the cold metal to try to get into a firing stance, but all the strength is out of me. I feel like my bones are empty, like my gut is made of paper mache, and any second I might bust open. I've got secrets to share with you, Hank. So much wisdom, I promise. Let me open up your eyes. All you have to do is say yes. Yes, yes, yes. Something tickles me, and I reach up to feel my cheek, and my fingers come away shining with a layer of ice. No, 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 I'm crying. I'm crying real hard, and I can't stop because I'm about to disobey my mama. I promised her, but this is too hard. Don't you ever pray to it, Hank Cotton, she told me. Please, I'm saying to the light. Please, please, please. But the spook light is talking to me around the edges. Edges I can't see, but I can hear. It's a little burning bush in the palm of my hand. I don't remember picking it up. You're my chosen one, Hank, chosen to rise above the rest. In my light, you'll become as a god to your fellow man. Yes, I say. And I could swear I'm standing still, and the world is moving around me, walking now. Columns of trees marching around me, snow kissing my boots, moving me out of these woods and back to the campfires, back to the world of men. I can feel the bare tree limbs arched high above me, black as rifle barrels, and creaking in the Arctic wind, but I feel warm now. Warm all over with this keen light shining on me again. My strength is back, and it's growing. I'm marching out of these woods strong as a bull with a spook light in my hand, and a big old grin has found its way onto my face. It's mine. The light is all mine. And that's the end of that. So, thank you everybody for coming out, and just have to say that it was a huge pleasure to get to go back to Robopocalypse and revisit that world and extend it further. And you know, I went out there and found the battered remnants of Grey Horse Army, and I brought them back to Oklahoma. And I can't guarantee that they're not banged up halfway to hell by the time they make it. And not everybody does make it, but I do hope that you guys will pick up a copy and stick around for their march. Also, if you have a nanny, think twice before you let her read this. It might scare the shit out of her. Thanks. So now I'll take questions, if anybody has them. Yes. Yeah, it was always a plan for a sequel. And if you read the first one, everyone's like, what's the earthquake about? There's a sort of a mysterious earthquake that happens in the last couple pages. And that was me setting up the sequel with the idea that if you generated vibrations that were earthquake level, you could encode information in it. And then I ended up talking to seismologists and lots of my more technical friends, and they were like, no way. And I was like, well, I already set it up in the first one, so find a way, you know. And so I actually had to make a lot of considerations as a result of the minuscule amount of technology that you could actually transmit in an earthquake. And so, but I was able to carry it forward. So it was always my plan to have a sequel. And I think if you read this book, you'll see it's pretty clear that I would love to go back and write a third one, as long as enough people enjoy this one. Any more questions? Yes?
So on a personal level, what spurred the transition from researcher to novelist?
So the question is, on a personal level, why did I transition from doing science into writing science fiction? And, you know, I have always wanted to do both. As a kid, I really wanted to write science fiction, but I've thought of that as something of a kind of a far-fetched career to go for. So I also love science, so it was not a tough decision for me to study computer science and then to go on and study robotics, which was awesome. I mean, I don't know how everybody doesn't study robotics. It's there. I mean, you look at all the possible things you can study. All the majors are there on a piece of paper, and one of them says robotics. So anyway, that was really fun. But I had this opportunity when I wrote How to Survive a Robot Uprising, which was kind of a little book. It was nonfiction. It was sort of silly, but it did okay. And I realized that I had this opportunity to sort of walk through this surprise door that had opened and write about, you know, the stuff I love and the stuff I love to think about. And so I walked through that door thinking, I'm sure this will peter out and I'll be back building robots in a year. Oh, maybe 2 years, maybe three. And I've actually just reached the point where, who is it? Gladwell, he talks about like your 10,000 hours or whatever, you know, like I did 10,000 hours of robotics. You know, I did 10 years studying engineering and AI and robotics. And now I've just reached a point where I'm out another sort of 10 years from that. And I've accumulated 10 years of just being a writer. So finally, I feel like I'm escaping, you know, I've hit like escape velocity or whatever from being a scientist. And I feel like for me to be a scientist now would involve slowing all the momentum I have and going back the other way. Or I could just be a Superman like Neal Stephenson and do both at the same time. Doesn't seem like it's in the cards unless they invent a neural implant that's going to make me smarter. Yes? What authors are an inspiration for me? Well, I have to say, one thing that is amazing about writing a science fiction novel is, so I wrote a lot of nonfiction stuff, right? And I did a lot of journalism. And then before that, I was doing robotics. The amazing thing is you suddenly have like your magic pass card to like go talk to other authors. And you're like, I'm one of you. See, look, it's a real book, you know, like, so So what I've been doing is I've teamed up with John Joseph Adams, who's like an anthologist extraordinaire, like an amazing, amazing guy. When I was in high school, I was submitting lots of terrible stories to the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, and that's where John like worked for years. It's like a two-man operation, which I did not know as a kid. I thought it was like a monolithic, like, this is where science fiction happens. But anyway, so working with John, I was able to kind of like solicit stories from lots of science fiction authors and be able to interact with these people and just get their stories in my collection and even edit them sometimes, which feels so wrong, you know, because you're like, oh, all right, I'm not worthy. And then, oh, but if you could just fix this, that's a little... So, you know, to give you a specific answer, one place where I got a lot of inspiration recently was I co-edited an anthology with John called Robot Uprisings that came out last month. And, you know, there's this guy named John McCarthy who coined the term artificial intelligence. He's like the man. He's the one who started the field of AI, basically. He's the father of artificial intelligence and teaching machines to really think. And he wrote a programming language called Lisp that if you're in school and if you're old like me, we all learned Lisp at some point in AI class. And so John always had, he's passed away, but he's always had this story that I knew about on his Stanford website for posterity. And it's a little science fiction story. And this guy's published 100, you know, he's won every possible prize and just a towering figure in the field, but never published fiction. And so I went back and found his story and drug it off of his webpage and contacted his relatives and got permission to publish this story in Robot Uprisings. And watching his scientific brain tell this story, he literally had Lisp code in the story describing the inner function of a robot that was making a decision. And there's all these utility values. And I don't know, but if you programmed it, you might get something out of it. I was in the funny position of actually fixing his grammar and stuff, but also and syntax, but also compiling his code, you know, like actually fixing his code and debugging, making sure they're all the parentheses lined up. So anyway, I drew a lot of inspiration from John McCarthy and watching his scientific brain convert really profound ideas and really prescient ideas into a narrative and into a story, and watching how he did that. Because, you know, there's a lot of value to just making really fascinating predictions about the future or coming at it from a unique angle. But it's the story that really matters. And so, yeah, good old McCarthy. Yes? Yeah, the movie. Oh, the movie. So, Robopocalypse was purchased by DreamWorks, and Steven Spielberg was attached, and there were lots of scripts written by amazing screenwriters who are writing stuff like Star Wars now. God, I don't want to torture myself. So, the movie was delayed, and, you know, the movie was going to be, like, really expensive, and so Steven balked right at the last minute, and pulled back and had it rewritten into a smaller, sort of more self-contained movie, and they could shoot that thing tomorrow or in 10 years. I have no idea. I'm not involved anymore. But early on, I was involved. While I was still writing the book, I was working with the screenwriter at the time and the production designers, and they were giving me pre-visualization. So they were drawing the stuff I was writing while I was writing it, which was kind of an interesting feedback loop. You don't usually have a team of like the world's best concept artists showing you what a spider tank looks like. And then you go to them and you're like, or like a mantis, you know, and then you go back to the world's best concept designers and you're like, guys, why are there human decals and lettering all over the mantis? That was built by an artificial intelligence. It doesn't need like military decals. And they're like, oh, that's right. Okay. But they look cool. So they're staying. Okay. Fair enough. So that's where that's at. But, you know, what it did was it really opened the door for me, and I got involved in a lot of other projects and had a lot of other new opportunities because of it. So, you know, whether or not it happens, I'm obviously very thankful about it. And And as it turns out, I did get a little movie made of a short story that I wrote called The Nostalgist for Tor.com. And it's free. You can go find it online. It's on my website, danielhwilson.com, or a link is. And some European filmmakers really loved this short story, and they made a short film, and they've just completed it, and it's absolutely amazing. They had a Kickstarter campaign and raised $50,000 for it, and it's going to be in the Palm Springs International Film Festival and then the Gifoni Festival. It stars Lambert Wilson, who is the Merovingian from the Matrix movies. He's a quintessentially French kind of guy, and he's actually very famous in France because he's in all these French movies that are sponsored by the French government to promote French culture. He's very French. Did I mention that? And the director is very Italian. His name is Giacomo Cimini, which is the most Italian name I've ever heard of, and I have to say this with my hand like that. That's part of it. So, you know, I'm excited about all the ancillary opportunities that I've had, but and we'll see about the big kahuna. I just want to make sure that you've, because I saw you raise your hand earlier.
I was just wondering what current science fiction you like to read.
Yeah, well, so I read, what I've been reading right now is I just got this crazy job from DC Comics. So DC Comics calls me up like a year ago and they say, do you want to write comic books? And I said, I'm a science fiction guy. I like comic books. I'm not obsessed with them. Are you sure you want to hire me to do this? And they're like, yeah, absolutely. That's what we love about you. That'd be terrific. Great. And I'm like, okay, I'll do it. And then they don't call me for a year. Then they call me suddenly and they say, okay, you're in charge of 26 issues. They're coming out weekly. You've got a team of like three or four writers. Some of them have already quit. And like, we got to do this right now. We're taking you to New York. So what I've been reading is all of Earth 2, all of Power Girl and Huntress, you know, World's Finest. I've been reading a ton of DC Comics, you know, to like make sure I have everything lined up. So, but in terms of science fiction, I recently read a really great debut novel by an author named Kenneth Calhoun called Black Moon. And, you know, normally I don't go for the straight literary stuff because I like plot. You know, I mean, you can tell I like plot. But I do appreciate a finely turned phrase, right? And so Black Moon, I love it because it's right down the middle. It's science fiction-y. It's a world where the premise is that people just suddenly can't sleep. And very quickly, the world goes to shit. I mean, it just starts spinning out of control. And as people are sleep-deprived, their way they speak, the way that he describes the world changes, and it gets quite literary. It's almost poetic. And it's like the perfect excuse to give me that literary pill, you know, and make me swallow it, because it's so plot-driven, and it's all about people that can't sleep. So Black Moon, it was a good read. I enjoyed it. Yes, sir. Sorry.
I was wondering what you can say about the potential movie for Ant.
Yeah, man. So this month has been very exciting. I actually have lots of things going on that I probably can't talk about. God, I can't. I want to. Bad. But there will be news this month probably on Amped. And I have it packaged with a very famous screenwriter. And he has his own take on the material, which is really fascinating. And he's going out with it. He's got a pitch and he's going out with it this month. And we should, you know, I should hear whether it sinks or swims this month, you know, so... We'll find out. Thank you. Yeah, I'm really rooting for him. Thank you. Well, okay, guys. Thank you very much for coming to my talk. I appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.